Usually, when we talk about a major technology shift, there's this, underlying expectation of a gradual slope.
Right, sort of adoption curve.
Yeah, exactly. Like, think about the smartphone. You get the first iPhone, it's undeniably cool, but it takes years for everyone to actually have one in their
Oh,
pocket.
for sure. The networks have to catch up. Developers have to build the apps.
Right. It takes years for services like Uber or Instagram to physically reshape how we navigate cities or, how we communicate. Society has time to absorb the shock.
Which is comfortable. We like having time to adapt.
We do. But, and this is the crazy part, you step into the world of artificial intelligence this week, the week of August 9, 2026, and that gradual curve is just gone.
It's completely vanished.
It is a sheer cliff
It
face.
really is a paradigm rupture. I mean, we are watching the bedrock of the internet crack and reform in real time right now.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're going to unpack today. Welcome to this deep dive. The overarching theme of this week's massive stack of research, news, and essays is, well, it's the dispersion of power and the immense violent friction that dispersion
Yeah,
creates.
we're aggressively moving away from a centralized world.
Right? The world of giant AI labs and monolithic platforms holding all the cards, we're accelerating into a highly fragmented reality of open-weight models, hyper-customized silicon, and, autonomous agentic workflows.
That's a massive shift.
Think about the transition from mainframe computers in the 1970s to personal PCs in the 1980s. You went from this massive centralized room where you had to beg the priesthood for computation
To
time.
having the machine sitting right there on your own desk.
Exactly. We are seeing that exact same mainframe to PC transition right now, except it's happening at a million times the speed. And the stakes are just so much higher for you, the listener.
And I mean, power doesn't disperse quietly. When you take capabilities that used to require a multi-billion-dollar data center footprint in San Francisco, and you push them out to the extreme edges of the network,
To individual developers and open source communities.
right, or to custom enterprise servers. Things break. The legacy infrastructure, the old economic models, the very way we write software, it's all buckling under the strain right now.
So let's jump directly into the epicenter of this earthquake. Let's look at the foundational restructuring happening at Google DeepMind.
Which is arguably the most important AI lab on the planet.
Without a doubt. And its leadership just underwent a massive transformation. Demis Hassabis, the man who has led DeepMind since he literally founded it, is stepping back from the day-to-day operations.
Wow.
Yeah, he's transitioning to become the chief scientist of Alphabet as a whole.
And Corey Cavicchioglu, who, has been there for 13 years and served as CTO, he's stepping up as senior vice president to run the actual day-to-day machinery of the lab.
Right. And Hassabis sent a letter to the team that was characteristically intense. He wrote, let me find it. He said, "We have arrived at a pivotal moment in human history. I've been working towards AGI my whole life, and now I feel it is close at hand."
That is a heavy statement.
Extremely heavy. He explicitly states he wants to focus on the big picture and science, but I have to play the skeptic here for a second.
Go for it.
Is this really about artificial general intelligence being close at hand, or is this just the classic visionary founder realizing that, managing the integration of AI into Google Workspace is just soul-crushing work?
That's a fair cynical read. I get it. Fighting over quarterly API margins isn't glamorous.
Yeah.
But I think the structural reality of Alphabet points to something deeper here.
What do you mean?
Well, when Hassabis steps back from product reviews to focus entirely on AGI, safety, and his work at Isomorphic Labs with drug discovery, it signals a massive internal calculus shift.
Like they're splitting the focus.
It's exactly. Google is structurally acknowledging that AGI research and consumer product engineering are no longer the same discipline. For the last 5 years, the narrative was that scaling models for better chatbots would naturally lead to AGI.
Right, just make the chatbot bigger and eventually it wakes up.
Right, but this move suggests they've hit a bifurcation point. The science of AGI and the existential safety protocols required to manage it needs a firewall from the business of shipping generative search features.
That actually makes a lot of sense. It's a strategic uncoupling,
Yeah.
but that uncoupling looks even more extreme when you factor in the departure that completely stunned the industry this week. Jeff Dean is leaving Google after 27 years.
Which is just wild. For anyone building distributed systems over the last 2 decades, this is like hearing that the architect of the Roman aqueducts is leaving Rome.
Perfect analogy. I mean, he co-created MapReduce, Bigtable, TensorFlow. He is literally the reason Google could index the internet at scale.
He architected the infrastructure that made modern machine learning physically possible.
And now he's out. He and Sanjay Gemawat are starting an independent public benefit corporation focused on machine learning science. And yes, Google is backing it, but he is fundamentally leaving the mothership. Why?
Because the infrastructure requirements for the next decade of computing cannot be built inside the constraints of a legacy tech giant.
It's too slow.
It's too constrained.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what MapReduce did back in the day. It solved the problem of processing vast amounts of data across commodity hardware because the centralized databases of the 90s couldn't scale.
Right.
We're hitting a similar wall today with AI orchestration, memory bandwidth, and cluster synchronization. Dean's exit strongly suggests that solving these foundational physics-level problems requires a blank slate.
You can't rebuild the airplane while it's flying at Mach 3 carrying billions of users.
Exactly. You have to go build a completely new aerospace company.
So the center of gravity is moving outside the perimeter of big tech. And we are seeing that exact same dispersion with the models themselves. While Google is reshuffling its generals, Alibaba just dropped a massive open-weight model called Qwen 3.8 Max.
And it immediately skyrocketed to the top of the agentic index.
Right. From artificial analysis. For you listening, if you aren't familiar, why is the agentic index the one we care about now?
Well, it's the critical benchmark right now. We aren't testing if a model can write a passable sonnet or, you know, summarize a marketing email anymore.
You're past that.
Way past that. This index measures execution, multi-step reasoning, tool use, evaluating its own progress, and planning over long time horizons.
And Qwen 3.8 Max hit over 1,100 points on Hacker News the day it dropped. Developers are realizing the frontier has been breached by an open-weight model.
And they specifically highlighted the model's capability for what they call co-work.
Yeah, explain co-work, because that's a fascinating term.
It's not just sending a prompt and getting a response. It's a sustained, stateful, collaborative session. The model and the human iterate over complex code bases or architectural designs for hours at a time. It remembers the context of the whole session.
And we have to look at the geopolitical and economic reality of this. For the last 3 years, the prevailing consensus in Silicon Valley was that proprietary U.S. labs, your OpenAIs, your Anthropics, would always maintain a decisive, untouchable lead.
That was the conventional wisdom, yeah.
The theory was that the sheer capital required to buy compute, combined with U.S. export controls on high-end silicon, created an uncrossable moat.
But Chinese labs, like the Qwen team and DeepSeek before them, have responded to those hardware constraints with sheer, brutal engineering efficiency.
They didn't just give up because they didn't have the chips.
Not at all. They are finding algorithmic workarounds, they are optimizing distributed training architectures, and they are matching frontier capabilities while releasing the weights openly. The moat has evaporated.
The moat is gone. But, you know, the threat to the giant proprietary models isn't just coming from massive state-backed open models in China. It is coming from the exact opposite end of the spectrum, too. Microscopic, hyper-specialized models.
Oh, you're talking about the Neon and Castform news?
Yes. There was a fascinating collaboration this week between Neon, the serverless Postgres platform, and a startup called Castform. They took a tiny 4 billion parameter open source model.
And to put that in perspective for the listener, frontier models are estimated to be over a trillion parameters.
Right. A 4 billion parameter model is something you can run locally on a mid-range laptop without breaking a sweat. It's tiny.
Very tiny.
But Castform used reinforcement learning post-training to make this tiny model beat OpenAI's GPT-5.6 Sol, which is their most expensive, most capable frontier model specifically on enterprise retrieval tasks.
Beating GPT-5.6 with 4 billion parameters is just staggering.
And they achieved this at a 100x cost reduction. 100x.
Let's break down how they actually did this, because the mechanism is brilliant. The central bottleneck in enterprise AI is that a company's most valuable data lives in raw, unstructured databases.
Right. It's not neatly formatted text.
Exactly. So to train a model to understand that data, you traditionally need humans to sit down and manually annotate thousands of question and answer pairs to fine-tune the model.
Which is slow, it's expensive, and honestly, it's tedious.
Castform completely automated the human out of the training loop. They take a company's raw database. Then they use synthetic generation to create thousands of highly specific questions based purely on the schema of that database.
Okay, so the AI asks itself questions about the data.
Yes. Then they define a mathematical reward function based entirely on citation quality, meaning the model only gets rewarded during training if it successfully retrieves the exact right row from the database and cites it perfectly.
So it's not about sounding smart. It's about being factually precise.
Right. They let the 4 billion parameter model loose to essentially play a massive game of trial and error using reinforcement learning, optimizing purely for that specific database structure.
And because they are using Neon's lake-based search infrastructure during the training phase and deploying it on that exact same infrastructure at inference time, there is zero architectural mismatch.
The model isn't trying to be a generalist. It doesn't know how to speak French.
It doesn't know the capital of Peru.
It doesn't know how to write a Python script for a web scraper. It only knows how to navigate your specific company's database with lethal precision.
I love this analogy. I read this online. If proprietary AI from the big labs is like eating at a Michelin star restaurant. You know, it's an incredible, sprawling tasting menu, but it costs a fortune and you have to wait in line to get a reservation. These open models and the CastForm approach are like highly specialized meal prep kits.
Oh, that's good.
Right. They are tailored exactly to your specific metabolic needs. They cost pennies on the dollar and you cook them in your own kitchen. But I have to ask you, does this mean the era of the monolithic one giant model to rule them all is fundamentally over?
For enterprise workloads?
Yeah.
It absolutely is. I mean, look at the unit economics.
Let's hear them.
If I'm a CIO and I can take an open source 4 billion parameter model, run it through CastForm's RL pipeline on my proprietary data, and it beats GPT 5.6 at my specific internal workflow for 1% of the API cost.
It's a no-brainer.
The economic incentive to route every query out to a centralized API completely vanishes.
Yeah.
You deploy that specialized model on your own internal server.
You own the weights. You own the data pipeline.
And you only call the massive frontier model for the bizarre, extreme edge cases that your tiny model can't handle. The capability is dispersed from the central hub to the edge of the enterprise.
But software dispersion is really only half the equation here. You cannot run software, no matter how small or optimized it is, without physical hardware.
No, you can't.
And the silicon required to run these models is undergoing an evolution that is just as radical, but it's constrained by the brutal realities of physics and supply chains.
The physical limits of the AI boom are definitively here. Supply chain reports this week confirm that the entire global production capacity for HBM high bandwidth memory for the year 2027 is completely sold out.
Wait, we're sitting in August 2026, and the memory supply for the entirety of next year is just gone, 18 months in advance.
Completely spoken for. And we need to understand why this matters for the broader ecosystem. To process large language models, the bottleneck is rarely the compute cores themselves.
It's not the processing power.
No. It is how fast you can feed the model weights from the memory into the compute cores. That requires HBM. It's memory chips physically stacked on top of each other and placed incredibly close to the processor to minimize latency.
So it's a physical distance problem.
It's exactly. But building the fabrication plants to create HBM takes years and billions of dollars. Companies like SK Hynix, Samsung, and Micron are scaling as fast as physics and capital allow. But they have hit a hard ceiling.
The implication there is massive. If you are a hardware startup trying to build a challenger to NVIDIA, and you don't already have your 2027 HBM supply secured, you are dead in the water.
You literally can't build your chips. The constraint flows downstream and just cements the incumbent advantage for NVIDIA.
Which is exactly why the industry is being forced into radical architectural pivots. They have to bypass the memory wall entirely.
And that brings us to AMD.
Yes, AMD. They just announced the acquisition of a Toronto-based startup called Talos. And Talos isn't trying to build a better GPU, and they aren't fighting for HBM allocation at all.
They are building what they call MSICs, model-specific integrated circuits.
This blew my mind. Instead of running a software model's weights through general purpose memory and compute pathways, Talos is taking a specific model like Meta's Llama 3.18B, and they are physically etching the weights directly into the silicon layout.
They are turning software directly into standard cell logic.
It's just wild.
By storing the neural network weights in mask ROM instead of volatile DRAM, they completely eliminate the need for high bandwidth memory. The weights are physically hardwired into the chip's metal layers.
The performance numbers are staggering, though. Their first test chip, the HC1, achieved 16,960 tokens per second.
That is roughly 48 times faster than running the exact same model on a state-of-the-art NVIDIA GPU.
And their upcoming HC2 chip is designed to hardwire 20 billion parameter models. But I have to push back hard on this approach.
Why?
Well, I think about this visually, like music. Running a model on a GPU is like streaming music on Spotify, right? The developer can push an update, fine-tune the weights, and instantly the model changes. Etching a model into silicon is like pressing a vinyl record.
Oh, I see where you're going.
Once the grooves are stamped, they are permanent. Talzit admits that updating the model requires a whole new respin of the silicon's metal layers, which takes weeks or even months. In an industry where models become obsolete every 90 days, isn't tape-out lock-in a financial death trap?
If you are an enterprise trying to run an internal customer service bot, yes, it's a terrible idea. You need flexibility.
Right.
But think about the scale of a platform like OpenAI or Meta or Google Search. If you are serving a highly optimized model, let's call it GPT-6 Turbo, to 500 million users every single day, the inference costs are astronomical.
True. You are spending billions on electricity and GPU depreciation just to generate tokens.
Exactly. So if you can freeze a specific version of that model, etch it into a fleet of Talos MSICs, and get 48 times the throughput for a fraction of the power, the economics completely flip.
You just don't care that it takes 3 months to respin the silicon for an update.
No, because you plan to run that specific stable model version for 2 years to handle the bulk of your generalized everyday traffic.
So the future architecture is disaggregated. You use flexible GPUs to parse the user's initial complex prompt, but the second you understand what needs to be generated, you route the heavy lifting of token generation to these hyper-specific hardwired MSICs.
That's the vision, the one-size-fits-all hardware era, where a generic GPU trains the model, fine-tunes the model, and serves the model that era is ending.
And driving costs down to the absolute floor is the overarching goal everywhere. DeepSeek proved this again this week with their V4 Flash 0731 model. It scored 89% on the AIRC AGI-1 benchmark.
And the cost was 2 cents per task. 2 cents.
The AIRC AGI benchmark is vital because it tests fluid intelligence, right? It presents visual logic grids that require deducing underlying rules from first principles.
Things the model has never seen in its training data. It can't just memorize the answer.
Right. And DeepSeek achieved this high score using test time compute scaling.
Instead of relying on a massive pre-trained model to just spit out an intuitive answer, they let a smaller model explicitly generate thousands of internal reasoning steps.
Exploring different logic trees before committing to a final answer.
It's the commoditization of reasoning. We are entering a reality where deep, multi-step logical deduction is running on specialized silicon at the edge, and it's costing pennies.
But this forces an incredibly uncomfortable pivot for us. If fluid reasoning is a cheap commodity, what happens to the humans?
The existential question.
Yeah. What happens to the people whose entire careers are built on their ability to reason, analyze, and write code? Does human expertise even matter in 2026?
That is the central philosophical debate tearing through the developer community right now. And it was crystallized by a phenomenal viral essay this week by Sean Godek titled LLMs Reward Expertise.
Godek argues that the entire concept of prompt engineering as a standalone career was a mirage.
A total illusion.
The people getting the most out of LLMs aren't the ones who memorize some arcane syntax for asking questions. The people winning are the ones with deep, uncompromising domain expertise.
He points to a highly publicized paper released by OpenAI this week. They documented 10 distinct mathematical discoveries, actual novel advancements in theoretical mathematics made by human mathematicians collaborating with AI reasoning models.
And the case study that fascinated everyone was Terence Tao. Tao is widely considered one of the greatest living mathematicians. Mm. And Godek points out that Tao uses ChatGPT infinitely more effectively than a first-year math grad student.
But look at how he interacts with it. That's the key. A novice tries to use the AI as an oracle.
Right. They write a massive, detailed prompt, hoping the machine will just spit out the final proof.
And when it inevitably hallucinates or goes down a dead end, the novice doesn't know how to course correct. Tao uses the model as a highly capable but erratic sparring partner.
He sends very short prompts?
Yes. When the AI suggests a direction that he instinctively knows is flawed, he ignores it and forces the model down the path his intuition dictates.
He knows when the math looks weird. The AI isn't replacing him. He is the bottleneck. The hardest part of solving these complex problems is actually having the taste and the architectural knowledge to know what a valid solution looks like.
The AI flattens the execution curve, but it drastically steepens the expertise curve.
I read a brilliant response essay that compared programming with AI to cooking a steak. Technically, anyone can throw a slab of meat into a hot pan. An amateur with a smart oven and a meat thermometer can make something edible.
The AI lowers the floor.
Exactly. But a transcendent steak requires a lifetime of practice. Understanding the Maillard reaction, feeling the tension of the muscle to gauge the resting phase, knowing how the specific cut of meat responds to different fats. The AI doesn't raise the ceiling for the amateur. It raises the ceiling exponentially for the master.
This is exactly why the debate over software engineering is so aggressive right now. We saw two warring essays this week. One was titled, "Taste is All That's Left."
What was the premise?
The premise is that since LLMs can easily generate boilerplate functions and functionally correct code blocks, the only scarce resource left for humans to provide is architectural taste.
Like naming conventions and setting abstraction boundaries.
Right, deciding how data flows through a system, the high-level stuff.
But the rebuttal essay was furious. It was titled, "Code Was Never the Hard Part is an Insult." And I actually lean toward this author's perspective.
Really? Tell me why.
There is this arrogant narrative in Silicon Valley management circles that actual coding is just grunt work that can be outsourced to an LLM and that the idea men will inherit the earth.
Ah, right. The prompt-only CEOs.
Exactly. The author pushes back, arguing that writing highly performant, secure, memory-safe code in complex data structures is the hard part. It requires deep, grinding discipline. Dismissing it just because an AI can generate a plausible-looking Python script deeply devalues the actual craft of engineering.
That's a powerful point. And we are seeing this tension, the struggle to separate the machine's fluent output from the human's underlying understanding, spill over into pedagogy and government policy, too. Look at Denmark.
No. The Danish Education Ministry implemented a radical new policy for high schools this week.
It's fascinating. Students are no longer just graded on the written assignments they turn in. They now have to verbally defend their essays and papers to prove they actually understand the material.
It is a profound epistemological shift. For decades, we assessed understanding by assessing the output. If you wrote a good essay, we assumed you understood the history.
But LLMs broke that heuristic entirely. An AI can generate a flawless essay on the French Revolution in 3 seconds.
Right. And the Danish government realized that AI text detectors are structurally flawed and easily bypassed. So they stopped trying to police the tools and shifted the assessment back to the human.
They're essentially doing a thesis defense for high schoolers.
If you can't dynamically answer questions about the arguments in your paper, it doesn't matter if an AI helped you draft it. You haven't internalized the knowledge.
Exactly. It forces the human to remain the locus of understanding.
So if you are listening to this, wondering where you fit into this landscape, the takeaway is clear. Your domain knowledge is not a legacy asset. It is your primary multiplier.
Your biggest advantage.
The AI can draft the legal memo. It can write the API endpoint. But you have to possess the taste, the context, and the expertise to know if it's actually correct. Because as we are seeing this week, when you remove human expertise from the loop and just let automated systems run wild at scale, the dispersion of tech creates catastrophic real-world friction.
The systems we rely on are fracturing under the weight of this automation.
Let's talk about that friction. Let's look at the open web. There was a sobering postmortem published by a developer who runs a massive 1.5 million page reference website.
Yeah, he detailed a year-long escalating arms race against bots.
He implemented rate limiting, IP blocking, aggressive CAPTCHAs, custom behavioral detection algorithms.
And the staggering revelation was that 99% of his inbound traffic turned out to be AI scrapers.
99%.
These are training crawlers deployed by major AI companies, relentlessly vacuuming up the public internet to feed their models.
But let's talk about the economics of that at the TCP/IP layer. If I am an independent publisher, I am paying for server compute. I am paying for outbound bandwidth.
Right. Every packet costs money.
If 99% of the packets leaving my server are going to automated bots that will never click an affiliate link, never view a display ad, and never buy a subscription, my business model is mathematically dead. I am literally subsidizing the R&D departments of trillion-dollar tech companies by paying to serve them my data.
The open web operates on an unwritten social contract of reciprocal value. You provide free content, humans consume it, and you monetize their attention. LLM scrapers consume the bandwidth but provide zero reciprocal value. It turns the open internet into a tragedy of the commons.
Which means the only rational move for small publishers is to put everything behind a hard paywall or shut down entirely. The open internet just becomes a giant abandoned farm where AI models are the only entities left, endlessly grazing on synthetic data generated by other AI models.
And this pollution of the commons extends into open source security too. Researchers at JFrog uncovered a terrifying trend this week regarding the CVE system.
CVEs are the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures Database. It is basically the central nervous system for global software security.
And JFrog found that it is being flooded with AI-generated, completely fabricated vulnerability reports.
Let's use Skylight as the example here. Skylight is arguably the most widely deployed database engine on the planet. It's in your phone, your car, your browser. The maintainers suddenly started receiving critical CVE reports detailing massive security flaws.
But when human engineers spent hours tracing the attack vectors, they realized the code paths described in the reports didn't even exist.
The AI just made it up.
Completely fabricated. The models, likely prompted by automated bug bounty hunting scripts, were hallucinating incredibly plausible, mathematically complex vulnerabilities that were pure fiction.
This is an asymmetric attack on human attention. The open source defenders have a finite amount of time and energy. The AI-generated noise is effectively infinite and costs fractions of a cent to produce.
If you drown the signal in high-quality slop, the entire trust model of open source security collapses.
And this fragility, this breakdown of systems when confronted by unanticipated edge cases, isn't just happening in code repositories. It is translating into lethal physical consequences.
You're talking about the Wired investigation.
Yeah. Wired magazine published a devastating investigation this week regarding a medevac plane crash in Ruidoso, New Mexico. 4 people died. 2 pilots, 2 flight nurses.
It is a stark exposure of how deeply dependent our physical safety is on invisible, fragile infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
The NTSB preliminary report and the Wired investigation tied the crash directly to a U.S. military electronic warfare exercise.
The military was conducting GPS jamming exercises at the nearby White Sands missile range. They are testing how to operate in contested electronic environments, but they blanketed the civilian airspace with GPS interference.
And these pilots were flying a critical medical mission on a moonless night in mountainous terrain.
Modern avionics are deeply integrated with GPS. When the signal vanished, the pilots were forced to revert to legacy radio beacon navigation under high stress, low visibility conditions. They became spatially disoriented and flew into a mountain.
The terrifying part is that this wasn't a mechanical failure. The engines worked perfectly. They were victims of a cascading dependency failure.
The navigation system depended on the GPS signal. The pilots depended on the navigation system. And when the invisible infrastructure they implicitly trusted was removed without warning, the human fallback protocols failed. And the military has conducted at least 10 of these jamming exercises in the past year.
It is a violent collision between military electronic warfare doctrine and civilian infrastructure.
The friction of systems colliding is everywhere. We also saw legal friction collide with algorithmic architecture this week. A court in New Mexico ordered Meta to pay an additional $567 million, bringing total damages in a massive lawsuit to nearly $1 billion for knowingly harming children's mental health.
But the legal theory here is what really matters.
Right. For 2 decades, social media platforms have shielded themselves behind Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, claiming they are merely neutral bulletin boards hosting third-party speech.
If a user posts something awful, it's the user's fault, not the platform's.
But the jury bypassed that defense entirely. They found Meta liable not for the content users posted, but for the design of the algorithm itself.
The prosecution proved that Meta made deliberate architectural choices to maximize engagement. They knew full well that pushing borderline content, endless scrolling, and specific notification cadences heavily exacerbated mental health crises and child exploitation.
The court didn't just levy a fine. They ordered Meta to build dedicated algorithmic prediction models to identify users under 13 and fundamentally alter how the platform routes data to them.
They are holding the platform liable for the mathematical weights of its recommendation engine. It is a massive structural blow to the engagement-maximizing business model that has dominated the last decade.
And speaking of structural breakdowns, the illusion of digital ownership shattered again this week. Xbox experienced a massive authentication server outage,
which meant millions of gamers booted up their consoles, put a physical disc that they purchased into the drive, and were told they couldn't play.
Because the physical disc is no longer a self-contained product, it is merely a plastic DRM key. It triggers an online authentication check. If the centralized server is down, the local hardware is bricked.
We saw the exact same monoculture fragility in the enterprise space when GitHub Actions and Pages suffered an extended global outage. Millions of automated deployment pipelines, CI/CD workflows, and hosted websites simply stalled.
We have built an incredibly powerful global development infrastructure, but we've centralized it to the point where a single routing error in one company's data center halts global software delivery.
And before we close out this look at infrastructure friction, we have to address a massive disruption to the physical power grid that fuels this entire ecosystem.
Right, the energy supply chain. The U.S. administration reached a $1.2 billion agreement with the German energy firm RWE to halt their offshore wind lease projects off the coast of California, Louisiana, and New York.
And we are strictly looking at this from an infrastructure and supply chain perspective, to be clear. We are completely neutral on the politics of this.
Absolutely. No political stance here. We're just reporting the factual impact on the tech sector. RWE is taking that capital and pivoting to reinvest in conventional natural gas projects, including a massive LNG export terminal. Regardless of the politics behind it, this throws a massive wrench into the long-term capacity planning for the tech sector.
It definitely does. The hyperscalers, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, are projecting exponential growth in power consumption to run these next-generation AI data centers.
And they have structured their 10-year energy procurement strategies heavily around the anticipated grid capacity from offshore wind and renewables.
Exactly. When a gigawatt-scale wind project is abruptly halted and replaced with LNG, it completely alters the power purchase agreements, the grid interconnection timelines, and the carbon accounting models these companies rely on. It is a massive geopolitical variable injected into tech's supply chain.
It's a reminder that the cloud isn't ethereal. It is heavily dependent on physical turbines, gas pipelines, and grid policy. And as a quick capstone to the friction, we saw a barrage of security breaches this week, proving the fragility of our perimeters.
MIT researchers published the Tantu Spectre attack,
proving that speculative execution vulnerabilities, the ghosts of Meltdown and Spectre, are still a live, exploitable threat on AMD Zen 2 processors.
Anabil suffered a severe authentication bypass flaw, essentially a god mode bug that exposed downstream managed service providers.
And Shiny Hunters managed to breach a major cancer diagnostics company, dumping 10.9 million highly sensitive medical records. And they didn't do it with a sophisticated zero-day exploit.
They did it with basic social engineering, calling help desks and manipulating humans.
The friction is everywhere. The legacy systems are cracking. So how is the industry responding? By attempting to build entirely new software architectures designed from the ground up to natively handle this chaotic agentic future.
We are moving past the era where AI is just a conversational chatbot you ask questions to.
Mm-hmm.
We are entering the era where AI is an active, executing participant in the operating system.
Cloudflare made a massive splash this week by open sourcing Cloudflare OS. This is an enterprise operating system built on the premise that AI agents are first-class citizens.
But the obvious question is, how do you let an autonomous agent loose in your corporate network without it accidentally deleting your production database or emailing your financial projections to a competitor?
Exactly. That's the terrifying part of agentic workflows. Cloudflare OS solves this by utilizing isolated code runtimes, similar to V8 isolates used in edge computing.
They provide a strictly governed sandbox where agents can write and execute code at machine speed.
The agent is bound by cryptographic permissions. It can only access the APIs and data stores that you have explicitly granted it access to.
If a human employee figures out a highly complex multi-step workflow like pulling data from Stripe, cross-referencing it in Salesforce, and generating an audit report, the platform observes this, captures the procedure, and compiles it into a persistent instruction set.
That an agent can execute continuously in the background. It turns conversational intent into durable software.
But here's the architectural challenge with that. If you have an AI agent autonomously modifying files and updating code bases in the background, while a human developer is simultaneously working in that same code base, you are going to create horrific merge conflicts.
Oh, a total nightmare. How do you store the data?
That is exactly the problem the team behind the Zcode editor solved this week with the introduction of DeltaDB.
I saw this. DeltaDB is a profound paradigm shift in how we think about storage engines.
Traditional databases or text editors store a snapshot of the current state of a file. If two entities try to save different versions of the snapshot at the same time, the system panics.
DeltaDB abandons snapshots entirely and embraces CRDT's conflict-free replicated data types.
Exactly.
Can you explain how that actually works under the hood?
Sure. Instead of storing the document itself, DeltaDB stores a continuous append-only log of every single operation performed on the document, every keystroke, insertion, deletion, or format change.
Just a running list of edits.
Yes, because these operations are mathematically commutative, meaning they can be applied in any order and still result in the exact same final state. A human developer and an AI agent can simultaneously edit the exact same file in real time.
The database simply merges the streams of operations mathematically. The boundary between human action and machine action completely dissolves at the storage layer.
But if the agents are moving at machine speed, co-editing our files and executing workflows, how do we ensure they are acting safely? Historically, AI safety meant neutering the model during the training phase,
which is incredibly rigid. If you bake moral alignment into the model's weights during training, you get a black box model that refuses to summarize a medical text about anatomy because it triggers a hard-coded NSFW filter.
Mistral fundamentally rethought this approach this week with the release of Shieldstral. It is a highly optimized 3 billion parameter open weight model dedicated entirely to safety filtering.
Shieldstral decouples safety from the core generation model and moves it entirely to the inference time. You run your massive, uncensored generation model, but before the output reaches the user, you route it through Shieldstral.
And you don't write complex code to filter it. You just pass the context window to Shieldstral with a plain language query.
You ask it, does this text violate European GDPR banking regulations? Or is this image generation prompt safe to display to a minor in a high school setting?
Because it's only 3 billion parameters, it runs on a single, cheap 16GB GPU with almost zero latency overhead.
This is incredibly pragmatic. It allows multinational corporations to define custom, localized safety policies per jurisdiction. What is considered a safe response in a healthcare application in Germany might be legally non-compliant in the U.S.
Shieldstral adapts to the fragmentation of global norms because the policy is an external query, not a baked-in ideology.
And speaking of pragmatic, high-impact AI, we have to talk about Google DeepMind's WeatherNext model. This is arguably the most objectively beneficial application of AI we've seen all year.
They published a paper in Nature demonstrating that WeatherNext achieved a decade's worth of meteorological progress in one single model architecture.
Traditional weather forecasting relies on massive supercomputers running numerical weather prediction models, essentially brute-forcing the complex physics of fluid dynamics in the atmosphere,
which is incredibly computationally expensive and slow.
DeepMind took a different approach. They co-trained WeatherNext on 20 terabytes of global atmospheric data and 5,000 historical storm tracks. They taught a neural network to understand the underlying patterns of atmospheric physics.
The efficiency gain is staggering. WeatherNext can produce 1,000 ensemble forecasts, calculating hundreds of potential probability paths for a storm system in less than a minute, running on a single TPU.
The real-world impact is that their three-day cyclone forecasts are now statistically as accurate as the old two-day forecasts. That is an extra 24 hours of lead time.
During Hurricane Melissa's rapid intensification over the Caribbean in 2025, WeatherNext accurately predicted the exact landfall vector a full day earlier than the legacy models.
Giving a coastal city an extra 24 hours to execute an evacuation plan is monumental. It is quite literally AI saving lives.
And DeepMind open sourced the underlying models for researchers globally. It's a powerful reminder that while we obsess over chatbots, AI's greatest legacy will likely be modeling complex physical systems and automating scientific discovery.
Which perfectly segues into Discovery Loop, a fascinating new open source tool that hit the top of Hacker News. It takes the interaction model we saw with Parents Tau and formalizes it into a reproducible programmatic workflow. Discovery Loop automates the scientific method.
You give it a massive data set and a broad research domain. The system employs LLMs in a continuous loop to generate novel hypotheses. Write the code to design an experiment, testing those hypotheses against the data, evaluate the statistical significance of the results, and then refine its theories based on the outcome.
Over and over again, thousands of times a day.
It takes the human out of the painstaking exploration phase entirely, only alerting the human researcher when it finds a statistically anomalous, verified result that warrants peer review.
And I want to pause and synthesize what we've just discussed in this section. If Cloudflare OS is handling the enterprise workflows in isolated runtimes, and DeltaDB is managing the simultaneous code generation seamlessly, and Discovery Loop is autonomously iterating through the scientific method,
what exactly is the human's role?
Right. Are we just the exhausted managers of a digital workforce? This exact question is driving a massive, profound cultural reckoning in the tech industry right now. We are seeing deep tech sadness, open source political wars, and a desperate return to the concept of craft.
There was an essay published in Noema magazine this week titled, "Why is everyone in tech so sad?" It struck an incredibly raw nerve, generating over 1,000 deeply personal comments on Hacker News.
The essay explores the spiritual exhaustion pervasive in the industry. We are looking at a sector with record-breaking profits, unprecedented compensation packages, and massive stock valuations. Yet the engineers actually building the systems are experiencing profound malaise.
Because the alignment between labor and meaning has been severed. Engineers feel they are dedicating their cognitive primes to building things they fundamentally don't believe in, optimizing ad click metrics, building algorithmic feeds that polarize society, or creating B2B SaaS tools that simply fuel other B2B SaaS tools.
There's a total absence of human flourishing in the output.
And when you combine that existential dread with the looming reality that AI models are increasingly capable of doing the intellectual heavy lifting, writing the boilerplate, structuring the databases, people are craving meaning. They are craving a return to tactile, difficult craft.
We see this tension fracturing the open source community along political and corporate lines. Look at the intense debate over AI-generated code this week. Oracle made a sweeping, draconian policy decision. They outright banned any AI-generated code from being submitted to the OpenJDK project,
which is the foundational open-source implementation of Java.
And let's be clear about the hypocrisy here. Larry Ellison regularly boasts on earnings calls about how Oracle relies on generative AI internally to rewrite their legacy applications. But when it comes to the open-source project they steward, they ban it completely.
Their stated reason is fear over copyright liability and unclear intellectual property provenance of the model weights.
It is a corporate maneuver driven entirely by legal risk mitigation. But contrast Oracle's fear with the stance taken by Linus Torvalds, the creator of Linux, on the kernel mailing list this week.
Torvalds explicitly defended developers, submitting patches written with the help of LLMs.
Torvalds' philosophy is pure, ruthless engineering pragmatism. He argued that the origin of the code is relevant. If a patch fixes a memory leak, passes the rigorous test suite, and improves the kernel, it gets merged.
Rejecting functional code simply because a machine assisted in drafting it is, in his view, an absurd form of prejudice. The code must stand on its own architectural merit.
So we have Oracle acting as the paranoid corporate lawyer, and Torvalds acting as the pragmatic chief engineer. But at the individual grassroots developer level, there is an entirely different reaction brewing. We are seeing the rapid rise of what one essayist coined the born against movement.
These are highly skilled hobbyist programmers who are completely refusing to use LLMs or AI coding assistants like Copilot. And crucially, they aren't refusing because they think the AI generates bad code. They know the AI is faster.
They are refusing because the process of writing the code is the entire point.
The essay made a beautiful comparison to woodworking. If you are a hobbyist woodworker, you can easily buy a 5-axis CNC router, download a CAD file, and perfectly machine a beautiful chair in 45 minutes.
But hobbyists don't do that. They use hand planes, Japanese pull saws, and chisels. They choose the slower, more difficult path because the tactile connection to the material, the required discipline, and the physical struggle is where the meaning resides.
Coders are starting to feel the exact same way about algorithms. If you let an LLM write the complex sorting algorithm for your side project, you have robbed yourself of the joy of puzzle solving. You've outsourced the only part of the project that was actually intellectually fulfilling.
And we saw spectacular, joyful examples of this creative resistance this week. A developer going by the handle Phobos Lab built a brand new, fully playable 3D first-person shooter for the Nintendo 64 in 2026.
He built a game called Zebulba 64 from scratch, writing entirely in C and raw in-paste assembly language.
This is the ultimate embrace of constraint. Building for the Nintendo 64 architecture requires an intimate, punishing understanding of the hardware. You are dealing with the reality signal processor and the reality display processor.
The most brutal constraint is the TMEM, the texture memory cache. It is exactly 4 kilobytes. You can't even fit a modern compressed smartphone app icon into 4 kilobytes.
Every single pixel, every MIPMAP, every memory allocation must be deliberately, painstakingly calculated by the human brain. You can't ask an LLM to optimize for a 4KB texture cache on a 30-year-old MEMS architecture because the model doesn't have enough training data on it.
It is a profound act of creative resistance. In a world defined by infinite, cheap, hyperscaled AI compute in the cloud, someone actively chose to spend hundreds of hours fighting extreme, localized hardware constraints.
And speaking of the 90s, Bethesda released a massive 30th anniversary update for Quake this week. They preserved the original raw soul of a game whose engine architecture fundamentally influenced every 3D application that followed it.
And we celebrated the 20th anniversary of Pandoc, the universal document converter, built almost entirely by a single philosophy professor. We also saw the release of FFmpeg 9.0, the open-source multimedia framework that quietly powers almost every video streaming service on Earth.
These milestones matter because they represent quiet, durable infrastructure. They were built by individuals obsessed with solving real, complex problems, not by venture-backed startups chasing a rapid acquisition. It proves that we still desperately want technology to bring us utility, stability, and joy, not just relentless automated efficiency.
And if we need a final palate cleanser to definitively prove that point, we have to mention the physicist who made headlines this week. He connected a tachometer to his pet hamster's exercise wheel, wrote a custom script, and linked it to the Strava fitness app.
It is the most magnificent, absurd use of technology I have seen all year. The hamster weighs less than a golf ball, but it is logging massive, sustained mileage on its wheel every night. It is doing interval training.
And it now has more Strava followers and kudos than most competitive human runners on the platform.
It is exactly the kind of story we needed at the end of this chaotic week. It reminds us that technology at its absolute best is still a canvas for human and occasionally rodent expression and joy.
It's a reminder not to take the hyper-optimization of the tech world too seriously.
So let's take a breath and synthesize this incredible journey. We started with the rapid dispersion of AI power from the strategic restructuring at Google DeepMind and Jeff Dean's exit to Alibaba's open-weight Qwen models proving the moat is gone.
We looked at Castform, proving that tiny, locally hosted models can beat frontier APIs at enterprise tasks if trained on proprietary data.
We examined the brutal physical realities constraining the software, the HBM memory supply chain selling out through 2027, and AMD's Talus pivoting to hardwire model weights directly into standard cell silicon to bypass the memory wall entirely.
We saw the commoditization of reasoning with DeepSeek driving complex logic costs down to 2 cents.
We analyzed the immense friction this dispersion causes AI scrapers destroying the economics of the open web, hallucinations poisoning the open source security databases, and the tragic consequences of invisible infrastructure failing, like the GPS jamming that led to the Ruidoso plane crash. We saw Meta held liable not for content, but for the fundamental design of their algorithms.
And we explored the new architectures being built to handle this Cloudflare OS isolating autonomous agents. Zed's DeltaDB using CRDTs to allow humans and AI to co-edit seamlessly, and DeepMind's WeatherNext proving that AI's greatest potential lies in modeling the physical world to save lives.
But the core reminder I want you, the listener, to take away from this entire deep dive is this. Your deep domain knowledge is your absolute superpower. The AI can write the Python script, it can draft the legal memo, it can generate the boilerplate, but the AI is just the amplifier. You are the signal.
You have to possess the taste, the context, and the expertise to know what excellence looks like. The AI lowers the floor for the amateur, but your expertise is the only thing that raises the ceiling.
When the cost of generating content and code goes to zero, the only scarce resource left is human judgment.
Which brings me to a final, slightly chilling piece of literary synchronicity that someone on Hacker News discovered this week. Ray Bradbury published his classic sci-fi collection, The Martian Chronicles, back in 1950. One of the most famous short stories in that book is titled There Will Come Soft Rains. And the date that story is set on is August 4th, 2026.
A date that we literally just passed this week.
Yes. And if you haven't read it, the story describes a highly automated, artificially intelligent smart house. The house continues to make breakfast. It cleans the floors with little robot mice. It manages the climate control, and it reads poetry out loud to empty rooms.
It is executing all of its workflows perfectly, completely unaware that its human family has died in a catastrophic nuclear event. The house just keeps running the routines, optimizing its tasks for a humanity that is no longer there.
Bradbury wasn't trying to predict smart thermostats or Roombas. He was issuing a profound warning about what happens when the technological systems we build become decoupled from the human meaning they were originally designed to serve.
Exactly. So as we build Cloudflare OS, and as we deploy autonomous agents, and as we architect massive systems that execute and iterate at machine speed without human intervention, we have to ask ourselves a fundamental question. Are we building tools that serve our flourishing, that elevate our craft, and that augment our understanding? Or are we just building the automated house of 2026, perfectly optimized to keep running the enterprise routines and generating the code long after we've rendered ourselves obsolete? Something for you to mull over until our next deep dive.